Schools across the city are canceling prom this spring. Mayor Curry says his Jobs for Jacks plan is just what the city needs. And activists demonstrate downtown for police reform. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, renowned broadcast journalist Mort Krim on his life in the news and how he loosely inspired Will Ferrell to play him in the Anchorman movie. It's all inside the pages of his new book, Anchored. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you. Radio host Angela Spears of Angela Spears Communications. Hi, Angela.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Our regular contributor, Charles Griggs, back with us. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. And Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record. Hey, Mike.
Morning, Melissa.
Lots to talk about this week, and we'll go to your calls in a moment. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Let's begin with prom, or rather the lack of prom night happening all around town. Eight Jacksonville high schools have canceled the prom this year, and they're citing low interest on the part of the kids. Mandarin, Ed White, Englewood, Stanton, A. Philip Randolph, Jackson, Darnell Cookman, and Wolfson High Schools all say no dice to the spring prom, and more schools may follow suit. Now, the cancellations came just as the Duval County Public Schools issued new guidelines on how to hold proms in this time of pandemic. We are going to begin the hour with a look at this, and in a moment we'll talk about the latest in the process to rename some schools in town. What are your thoughts about this, everyone? It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can let us know your thoughts about this on Facebook. David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. The class of 2020 last year and the class of 2021 this year, they've really had it rough. They've missed out on so many of the rituals of high school due to the pandemic. But what's interesting about this is that the kids are opting out of prom. Any student who attends prom would have to transition to virtual learning for 10 calendar days following the event. I guess that wasn't appetizing for a lot of kids. Prom has to be held at an outdoor venue, not indoors. Face coverings, temperature checks would be required at the prom. So it's kind of sad to see this, honestly. Another high school ritual gone by the wayside for this generation of youngsters.
It really is. This is definitely a generation that has learned a life lesson in spades about how life is a series of trade-offs, and that's becoming the case here at the end of what would be the senior year for a lot of students. You know, I can understand why the students would probably be reluctant, and to some extent, is it really a prom if you're outdoors? I mean, if you're having to wear face masks during it, I just have this visual image of a couple slow dancing and
with their masks,
in, you know, yeah, and then coming in for that kiss and kissing each other through masks. It just seems a little bit surreal and like a surrealist painting there. So I can understand that students are like, you know, I to be able to be with somebody for one day and then not be able to be at school with my friends for 10 days. Okay, so they just decide it's better off to just be there with their friends and stay within, not have to go back to virtual learning.
And Charles, that shows you that the majority of kids prefer going to school every day rather than learning on Zoom.
Yeah, the students do prefer seeing each other in person. I mean, it is, you know, they're social. You know, they're kids. We were all that age some time ago, and we remember probably that some of the best parts of our days were being spent with our friends, even in a learning environment. But, you know, this is the A1 social event of the year if you're a high school student, right, typically. And the fact that all of these requirements narrowing the participation or how you can engage because of the pandemic, you know, it can't be too inviting. I mean, you know, you throw your hands in the air and say, hey, you know, it would be probably best if we just don't do it, if we have to abide by all of these guidelines for an event. And then, you know, in all fairness, you know, to the administration, they have to operate in an abundance of caution by making these narrow requirements for an event such as this to be held, so that, you know, they can show due diligence in making sure that children are safe.
Mm-hmm. Angela Spears, you know, in Springfield, a group of moms is getting together to hold a small little prom party for the high school seniors that live in Springfield. So parents are doing what they can to help kids through this time. It's something to think about coming out of this pandemic, all of the rituals and traditions that we have taken for granted for so long in our society. Some of them might not be coming back, or at least they'll be forever changed.
And that's so sad. And I agree. I see it on both sides, Melissa, right? We know for safety reasons why it has to be done. But like you're saying, the rituals, because as it's been said before, we remember what it was like on prom. So when they have their 10-year class reunion, this is what they're going to sit back, Melissa, and talk about. Saying, yeah, remember how we didn't have a prom because people wore masks? I know when I went back for my 10-year class reunion, we were saying, hey, when we graduated, we went to war. 10 years later, we're at war again. Right? Because I graduated in 91, and it was Desert Storm, and then we went back, and it was 9/11. So these are going to be the stories that they have to tell. So it's unfortunate for the young people that they can't do it. And I understand why. And it's good that moms and dads, or that you're doing it in your circle, right? If they're going to have something in their home or in their little circle, so that they can somewhat have a semblance of a prom and dress up and have some fun with their friends.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Lots of tweets. Here's a few. Mike Mendenhall, Bill says, what is really sad about this? Aren't there other things better? Well, maybe prom wasn't so great. Dave tweets, it's a relief for every kid who doesn't get asked to go. Another tweet, there will probably be house parties and private parties instead. Katie tweets the show, taking a week off school after prom just isn't feasible or desirable for some kids. Katie goes on to say, maybe they wanted the party, but not at the expense of losing a week of school and partying on a football field with masks and social distancing. So, you know, Mike Mendenhall, as this goes on, the Duval County Public Schools are also in the news because voting to change the names of 9 schools is going to be underway. Let's talk about Lee High School. There are names on the ballot to rename Lee High School. They are Riverside High School, Avondale High School, Legacy High School, School Number 33, which I hope doesn't get it. That wouldn't be so much fun for the kids. But voting kicking off Monday. It's open to students, staff, PTA, parents, alumni, and anyone that resides in the school's zoning area. So that gives you a window into the process for the school renaming, which is also going on right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the leadership of the Duval County Public School District has had to make a lot of tough decisions and several generational changing events, and this is just an example of one of them. And I think that, you know, the cancellation of prom, you know, has that direct immediate impact on these students, you know, whereas, you know, that you can, world events typically, you know, typically, you know, they have an overarching feeling, you know, in a school. But I mean, and these types of rituals have been able to be used to, you know, to find solace and comfort and kind of have some semblance of normalcy. Whereas, you know, the cancellation of prom is this year, it just makes it all the more immediate. And then you have the issue of these schools, you know, being renamed and causing a lot of stir regardless of the outcome, you're gonna have a generation of students who are gonna have some very strong memories of what happened during their tenure.
Yeah, you know, David, I think you touched on this. This generation is absorbing a really difficult series of experiences at a tender age, and it will affect the way they see the world, the way they eventually govern this country. It, for us who are a little older, I think it's hard to really grasp what this has been like for younger Americans and how it's going to just shape everything in their lives that comes afterwards. This has been a defining experience for this generation, and we see it in our own household with our own children. I'm speaking, you know, for myself.
No, I think that's right. For sure, Melissa. And you think about last year, you had high school seniors who had been looking forward to playing their final season of spring sports, and that was completely canceled. So that was a huge letdown for a whole bunch of students there. It's a little bit better this year in that they are doing the sports at least. But I think there's a definite, what is the psychic effect of this long term? And then I think it's just this sense that's probably going to be there that this could happen again, and that most likely it will happen again. And so I think there's a feeling among people that they cannot really take for granted the ability to be able to gather in large crowds. And to some extent, you know, maybe we felt that already in terms of, you know, say something like a terrorist attack at the Boston Marathon and the feeling of being vulnerable. But I think this takes that feeling of vulnerability to an even higher level when you just think about how one case of this infection in China turns into this worldwide pandemic that turns everything upside down. So I think there's a real feeling of vulnerability this group of students, younger people, are going to grow up in as they move into the wider world.
I think that's absolutely right. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. You can call us at 549-2937. Tweet the show at Melissa N. Jax. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Let's talk about some other big news and notes from the week. This week, Mayor Lenny Curry and City Council President Tommy Hazzouri filed a bill to add a 6-cent tax to every gallon of gas purchased within city limits. Now, the mayor unveiled the plan last month, and he calls it Jobs for Jax. Curry says the nearly $1 billion in infrastructure projects generated by this would create up to 7,000 jobs and pump billions of dollars into the local economy. This gas tax would also free up more money in the city budget to phase out septic tanks across the city, which is very much needed. Charles Griggs, Jobs for Jax, can it pass city council? And is the biggest hurdle the hundreds of millions of dollars that this plan would spend on the Skyway, revamping and overhauling the downtown people mover into autonomous vehicles, essentially driverless cars?
Yeah, Melissa, for the most part, the public sentiment seems to be that this investment into the community and into infrastructure projects is very much needed. You know, I'd like to know more about the 7,000 jobs. That's a large number that, you know, will be created. We don't know how long that would be, maybe a 7-year period or 10-year period or whatever. But it looks like a great investment into the community for infrastructure. We've been talking about this for years. I can recall back to the study on consolidation back in 2014 that the city council put forward. It talked about, you know, needed investments in the infrastructure. And we've been talking about this for a long time. The fact that this is actually moving into some type of legislation is encouraging. You know, however, you know, people are going to be, you know, the administration as well as the JTA are going to have to, you know, get behind public, you know, and do some public engagement and figure out how to get people beyond looking at the Skyway improvements as the Skyway Express improvements. As you heard CEO Nat Ford mention, you know, he's technically renaming that project to the U2C Ultimate Urban Circulator. Mm-hmm. That messaging is going to be important because they have to convince the community that this is transportation reimagined for this community in order for people to get behind that type of investment because of the, you know, just because of the fact that what was promised from the Skyway years ago never really came to fruition. So in order to get people invested mentally into this project, they're going to have to do their part, their due diligence in helping folks understand what the real significant outcomes are for a project like this in terms of improving infrastructure and transportation in our community.
Let us know your thoughts. Should the city raise the gas tax for all of these infrastructure projects? And do you think it should be used to overhaul the Skyway? 549-2937. Yes. Now, Angela Spears, redoing the Skyway would connect it via the autonomous vehicles to places like the Riverside Arts Market, UF Health Jacksonville, the VA Outpatient Clinic, San Marco, the football stadium. These are all of the places people have long said the Skyway should go so that people can get to popular nodes around town without needing a car. Now, that said, critics of this expenditure think it's a lot of money to spend when there are so many other critical needs around the city. For example, when we spoke with the editors at the Jackson Mag the other day, they really study transportation and urban planning issues. They said they'd prefer this money, almost $400 million, to go toward relocating the Amtrak train station from west of downtown over to the multimodal transit hub that's downtown now, and using the money to complete the Emerald Trail. That's the green belt that's being built around the city that people will be able to walk and bike. So what about that?
I get the changes for our Skyway for the people who work downtown. You know, if you're downtown, it's easy for you to hop on. Let's just say you have a doctor's appointment at UF, right? You're able to utilize that. But we need to think about some of that, of how it's going to expand. How is that going to help someone who lives on the west side? How is this going to help someone with transportation who lives on the north side, right? So we do need to think about investing the money in different places. And also, we need to make sure, going back to the septic tanks, Melissa, we need to make sure that the money goes where it's supposed to go. Because for so long, how long have we been talking about removing septic tanks from the north side, right? We need to make sure that this is done. When are we going to stop talking about it and actually doing it? Making sure that the money goes where it's supposed to go for the projects that it's supposed to go for. So I think that's something that people want to make sure. And if you're in these areas, people want other, we need to think about other ways to upgrade our public transportation system. Mm-hmm. If it's not going to be just the Skyway, maybe we do some type of rapid bus system, improving our rapid bus system that we currently have with JTA, right? Improving what we have so that if you're on the north side and you have an appointment at the beach, that it won't take 3 hours and 4 buses to change, right? So thinking of other ways, and if we need to utilize, like you're saying, the rail system or utilizing the Emerald Trail, whatever it may be, I think money needs to be invested. I don't think everything should be put into the Skyway, Melissa. Bottom line, everything should not be put into the Skyway. We need to make sure that we're putting the money in different places and that we're doing the projects that we do. And I agree with Charles that it's going to have to be that messaging. And you're going to have to let people know, because those who have the septic tanks are tired of hearing, oh, it's going to happen. It's going to happen in 2 years. They want it done now in their neighborhoods. And with those jobs, right, are they all going to be local? And how long will they be around? Those are questions that I'd want to investigate more.
So Mike Mendenhall, with some public skepticism out there, like the kind Angela just voiced, how big of a challenge will it be for the JTA to sell this plan to the members of the city council?
Well, you already have several members who are pretty outspoken against any type of expansion or modernization of the Skyway. Councilwoman Leanna Cumber has gone as far as to say that she'd rather spend, the $100 million to tear the existing structure down than to put the $372 million that's proposed in the bill to modernize it. That being said, Nat Ford, the JTA is really relying heavily on Nat Ford's established reputation here in Jacksonville. You know, their argument is that him, his leadership team, and the current JTA board, whenever they get a project put in front of them, they execute it. And, that's part of the selling point, is that, look, we haven't been wrong before, you know, since I took over. So, you know, trust us to get this done. You know, but there's a lot of popular projects in that bill. I mean, the other two thirds of that bill are going to go to road projects, bridges, curb and gutter, you know, just that bare bones infrastructure stuff that people want. So I have a tough time imagining that the city council members that will support this gas tax will let it die on the Skyway. I think that what I'm hearing is that, you know, if push came to shove, it probably could be eliminated from the bill.
Let's go to lots of calls on this. 549-2937. Juan is downtown. Hey, Juan.
Hey, how we doing today?
Great. What are your thoughts?
Well, okay, so if you compare us, let's say, to Miami, okay, Miami has a bunch of people, but they have a little skyway, and their skyway used to be like ours. Didn't go anywhere. All of a sudden, it goes to the other side of Miami. You know, if you go to Miami, you try to drive from one end to the other, like from Orange Park to Jackson, it takes you 3 hours. But you jump on their skyway, all of a sudden, you're downtown in 20 minutes, then it's gone. And you know what? If you don't think that that's going to happen in Jacksonville, you know, we better get ready now. That's what I'm saying. It's the time to do it. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for that. So, Charles, the people mover in Miami, that's been referenced in this discussion, how that has played out to our south.
Yeah, and that's a great reference for the potential of this project. And as you mentioned earlier, a large part of this will involve the automated vehicles, the autonomous vehicles that will help move transportation on and off the system. You know, this project has great potential. It's just a matter of the lingering thoughts of the Skyway Express as we know it that gives people heartburn. You know, this feels different than the discussion that we recall most recently around Lot J. This feels more like a conversation that the community is ready to have with their elected officials and the administration. So I don't anticipate a lot of, I mean, I think that they're going to be like Mike mentioned, that there's going to be some compromise here. But it'll be as people get engaged in this project. But it doesn't feel like there's really that type of antagonistic rhetoric going on around this effort, because people know that the infrastructure investments are important.
Yeah.
They just have to better understand what the real potential of this U2C project is and convince people to get behind it or not.
Richard is on the south side. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So, you know, the details are dribbling out kind of maddeningly as a member of the public. I read in the Times Union in the last couple of days, the intent is to really tear off the top of the Skyway, and I guess that means destroying the stations, ripping up the horizontal track, and just leaving the pylons. So I have to ask, you know, I've been to New York and I've been to London, and it's no big deal to move from one train that takes you from Regency to a station up onto the Skyway as it exists, take that across the river, which is really about the only value the Skyway has, is it has infrastructure that crosses the river, and pop down onto another autonomous vehicle on the other side. So, you know, why are we trashing things and building new expensive things when it would seem like a little sort of constructive flexibility needs to be built into this. The second point I made is when this story first broke, I followed the comment section on the Times Union, and there was not a single member of the public in favor of this. So thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Les on the west side. Hi, Les.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask if anyone has entertained the possibility of improving the, I don't know the term would be, making the traffic signals smart, trying to improve our efficiency on the roads that we already have.
I do think they have been working on those types of things, Les, for some time. But,
well,
you know,
it hasn't come to my neck of the woods.
Yeah. Thank you, Les. Andrew in Mandarin. Andrew, go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to talk about a little bit about the Skyway. I think the thing that defines a great city is being pedestrian friendly, and Jacksonville is anything but. The Skyway obviously is not working in its current form, and I watch it all the time, and it's just moving air from different parts of Jacksonville. I think the Skyway would be better.
Moving air.
Incorporating.
Right.
It's all it does.
It moves some people, but yeah.
Very rarely. The amount of money spent per person it would blow your mind if you put the numbers out there. But I think the Skyway would be better repurposed as a High Line, just like they have in New York City. I think it would be a unique use of the Skyway. People would actually use it. People would come to downtown Jacksonville to stroll along the High Line or Jacksonville High Line. It would be just a great way to use it. Jacksonville's main focus needs
and
to
let
be
me and Andrew, let me just explain, because I agree with you. I think that would be really cool. I don't think they're even considering it. But the High Line in New York is they took an elevated train track and they made it into a garden. You know, and you can walk along and enjoy it way up high. So I just wanted to explain what you meant by High Line.
The Skyway in its form right now is not accessible. People don't want to go up escalators to ride. It's not quick. It's not fast. The only way that it works is if it's street level, and that's what works in San Francisco. That's what works in other cities when you have lines that are street level, because then it doesn't take a lot of time. People can just access it quickly. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. Caitlin in St. Nicholas. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi there. I just wanted to share a little firsthand experience of what happened to me this morning. I was taking my 3-year-old to school, and he said, "Mommy, can we ride the Skyway this afternoon after school?" And I said, "Yeah, that would be fun. We should do that." But then I thought, oh my gosh, where would we eat dinner? What's open? I need to sit down and research what's open downtown at 6 o'clock. And I used to work downtown, so I actually have a very good idea of what is down there, but it's like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Things to do downtown or the Skyway? So I'll take my my answer off air.
Thanks, Caitlin. Okay, David Bauerlein, interesting to get the opinions from all neighborhoods of town about this.
Yeah, very much so. Just a couple of points. On the High Line, JTA did do a study back
in
2015.
Okay.
Where that was one of the options they looked at, and the task force decided that it was better to keep it as some form of a mass transit elevated structure. So they looked at it, costed it out. There's some cost to making it possible to have it where it's there for pedestrians and, I guess, bicyclists. And there's an operating cost, and you might have to repay the federal government because it would no longer be used as transit. But, yeah, it's a great array of voices there. Melissa, if I could just raise one thing that I think both Charles and Andrew brought up, and that was the job study. And the way I understand it is each job is a year of work. So if there's 7,600 jobs, that's the equivalent of 7,600 years of work by somebody. So if you did everything in 1 year, you'd have 7,600 jobs that year. But likely this is going to be spread over 5 or 10 years. So if you did this work on all these construction projects over 10 years, then that's an average of about 760 jobs per year.
Okay.
So that's the sense of how this works. It's an economic impact. It does create jobs. But when you look at the size of the Jacksonville metropolitan area in terms of the jobs, it's not a huge impact in terms of the economic impact.
Yeah. It's certainly not a surprise that a public official would give very enthusiastic jobs numbers that might not always stand up to reality. Thanks for pointing that out, David. So many calls on this. Brandon in St. Augustine. Brandon, hello.
Good morning. First time caller.
Great.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to shift the conversation only slightly into more of a macro perspective. It seems that whenever we're talking about funding infrastructure, gas tax always comes up. And my question is, where do electric vehicles fit into that arithmetic? You know, they're using the infrastructure, but, you know, from a layman's perspective, don't seem to be putting money into the kitty. Mm-hmm. And again, I appreciate you taking my call, and I will take the answer offline.
Thank you for that, Brandon. Thanks for calling. Angela Spears. Let's talk a little bit more about the gas tax. And this has come up a few times when we've discussed this, because converting to electric or hybrid vehicles is certainly on our horizon. The large automakers plan to be shifting production away from fossil fuels in the next decade or so. Many of them plan to do that, but it's not going to happen overnight. And so in the short term, most people will still be getting gas, regular gas, at the pump.
That's true. So I think that the caller had an interesting point of where do those vehicles play a role in all of this. And for those of us who are still using gas, Melissa, you know, you got to think about gas. Gas prices continue to go up, right? They continue to rise for whatever, you know, for various reasons that we know of nationally. And then adding more onto that for us, that becomes, I think, an issue for a lot of people. I don't know about for you, but for me, that causes a lot of issue. I understand of what it may go to, but we have to think about that as well of how is this going to impact our travel with what we're doing for those of us who are using gasoline and having to pump gas here in town with that gas tax. So I just think we've got to really, really think about it. People need to really voice their opinions on what they want. You know, are we going to sacrifice in the short term to get what we want in the long run is what it boils down to. You know, we're going to sacrifice now for later is what it all boils down to, I think, with this gas tax.
One more call on this, and then we will move on to some other stories from the week. Brian, also in St. Augustine. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, hi. I'm still here. Good morning.
Go ahead.
What I feel in my heart of hearts is that structure, the skyline, should be repurposed. It could still be used to move people, but it could also be roofed over as a solar farm. Generating electricity to charge these EVs that are coming, both commercially in terms of city transportation, but also in the private sector. The EV wave is coming. There's no denying it. I'm driving an ICE vehicle right now. When I have the opportunity, I will get a plug-in. This is the way it's going to go, and there's no turning back now. It's all about helping to save the planet, keeping our air relatively pollution free. It's a plus for Jacksonville to think ahead on this. You're not going to get results overnight. You might not going to get results in the next 2 or 3 years, but this EV wave is coming. I'm saying maybe 5 to 7 years. We already have part of the structure built, so let's use it gainfully instead of reducing it to rubble.
Thank you for that, Brian. Mike Mendenhall, the city is not, like most cities, is not getting ahead of this. We're sort of playing catch up. There are more EV charging stations around town than there used to be, and JTA has been working on that. But the caller is right in that this transition is coming, and our transportation grid is going to have to plan for it. It's a little off topic of the idea of whether we should fund the Skyway. But when you talk to JTA, when you talk to local officials, are they discussing this huge transition when they have these conversations?
I mean, you're not hearing a ton about, you know, about transitioning to electrified infrastructure. I mean, there's been talk at both JTA and JEA about that. And when it, in terms of, in context of the fuel tax, that's one of the arguments to leverage the tax is that, you know, we're in that last window right now where there would be enough revenue generated from a fuel tax before that EV transition really pushes forward. You know, that the argument is that over the next 30 years is going to be the last opportunity that they would have to gain revenue from that. You know, that being said, most of what you're hearing about transitioning to EV infrastructure is really coming from the federal level right now. You know, with you look at what the Biden administration is proposing with their infrastructure plan, a lot of it is to set up electric charging stations throughout the country and create that infrastructure. You know, but when you're talking at a city or a local level right now, I mean, we're still kind of in the infancy phases as far as talking about, you know, resiliency when it comes to, you know, storm surge and climate change. So, I mean, there's, you know, there, yeah, I think, you know, I think in general, we are a bit behind the eight ball.
It's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with Mike Mendenhall, Angela Spears, David Bauerlein, Charles Griggs, and yours truly. We're going to move ahead now and talk about a demonstration that happened outside the Duval County Courthouse Wednesday night. Advocates for police reform got there and gathered and spoke out in response to the verdict earlier this week in the Minneapolis murder trial of police officer Derek Chauvin. He was convicted of killing George Floyd. The activist said that the guilty verdict was a relief, but just one step towards justice, and they called for more civilian oversight of the police. Now, this demonstration came as legal challenges are already being filed in federal court against the state's new anti-riot bill, which the governor signed into law this week. He says it's a law and order measure. Critics say it criminalizes protest and also silences Florida residents' First Amendment rights. Charles Griggs, let's talk about this for a moment. This new law will make it more difficult for large-scale protests to happen in public places. There's a lot in the law, but that's the nut of it. Police have expanded powers to arrest and detain and charge with felonies. People that are at the scene of a protest where there's any kind of unrest. And the big criticism is that if you're at the protest and behaving lawfully and peacefully, just by being present at an event that turns violent, you could also be charged with a felony.
Yeah, there's a lot of room for ambiguity in the way that the law is written. That is the major problem with this, the fact that law enforcement can choose to interpret rioting. They have a wide berth to interpret rioting as they see fit. If you have law enforcement officials who are not particularly partial to peaceful protests or any type of protest at all, they can just use the ambiguity within the law in order to arrest people. And the other piece is that piece of important portion of the law is that people are denied bail. They have to sit there in jail. Where we saw some of the local protests, people were being bailed out by third parties for folks who didn't have the money. So this is a lot of strings, that puts a lot of strings attached to the way people are being protest, will conduct protests in the future. We've already seen lawsuits going to be coming forward on this because of the ambiguity in the law. And, we do have a right for peaceful protest. We do have a right to free speech. And, people, the critics are saying that this is a law in search of a problem. As Tallahassee and the governor's office have worked hard to produce to get this one. This is one of the first ones they came into sessions with, and out of the box,
HB1,
it received a lot.
Top priority.
HB1. So this is a top priority, and critics are saying that out of all the other things going on in Florida, why was this a priority? Because we did not have this any issues with protests here in Florida, especially during the last summer.
The governor says he pushed the law because he doesn't want to see the kind of violent protests other cities saw last summer in particular. The federal complaint that's already been filed against this says that the measure targets protected speech under the First Amendment and retaliates against protesters by imposing excessive bail, fines, or cruel and unusual punishment as a means of hindering the speech of dissenting opinions. That from the federal complaint. Angela Spears, I think most observers of Governor DeSantis feel that the kinds of moves he's making, and in particular with this anti-riot statute, you need to view those through the lens of his political ambitions. Of course, he is running for re-election in 2022 as Florida governor, but most people who followed his career believe he's positioning himself to run for president in 2024. And this kind of stuff will certainly help him in a Republican presidential primary.
This all, Melissa, goes back to show that voting has consequences, right? Of who we put in at the federal, the state, the local office, voting has consequences. So that's number one that we need to think of when we go to the ballot box, right? When we go to vote, we need to think about what our elected officials have done in the past, right? What they're doing now, what they're supporting, because this is a bill, Melissa, as Charles said, the ambiguity in it. Who is to determine if you and I, all of us today on this panel, if we decide that we're going to go out and hold a peaceful protest, right? Walk down the street. And if a JSO officer sees us, doesn't like us because they don't like the media, they could easily say, oh, that's violent, and arrest us all. So we really have to look at that. And that just goes back to showing you're saying about DeSantis's, his ambitions. Voting has consequences, people. So we need to look at who we're putting in office, what they're going to do, because if someone shows you who they are, believe them. Believe them, what that person tells you, as Maya Angelou said once, right? Just believe them. So I think we need to look at that. And there's a whole lot that needs to be asked in this bill that we need to continue to ask and continue to say, hey, why is this? And we need to contact our local, our state representatives, our state senators, and hold them to the fire and ask, why was this necessary? Why did you vote? And it was mainly on one party side, right? Why did you vote for this? What is needed in this? This hasn't happened, and people still have rights. And we have to remember that we all have the right to a peaceful protest. And I'm not saying that we need a riot, because I don't believe in tearing stuff down, burning up buildings, none of that. But we do have a right to peaceful protest. And in this way, people aren't going to do it anymore. They're going to be afraid, because they're going to say, hey, I'm going to be in jail, and I'll be in jail for 2 or 3 days before I'm able to get out, Melissa. So it all goes back to, I think, voting has consequences, and we need to consider that.
Mia in Murray Hill. Go ahead, Mia.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I just wanted to comment on kind of exactly what she was just saying. Going to jail for 2 or 3 days, we don't need another reason to be locking people up in, you know, confined areas while COVID still exists. So it just seems not worth at all, whatever the purpose is here, to try and arrest anybody who has been around a protest that turned violent. That just seems, that's the end of my comment.
Thank you. David Bauerlein, you know, it is already illegal to destroy private property, to become violent, to assault a police officer. There are already penalties for all of these kinds of activities, which critics of the new law in Florida have pointed out. What about the governor's argument, though, that this will prevent Florida cities from seeing the kinds of protests that resulted in the destruction of businesses, looting, for example?
Well, I think there's laws against that as well. Part of what's being contested in this law is stuff like a provision for mob intimidation. What is mob intimidation? How do you define that? Who's responsible, criminally liable for that? It's a very open-ended, seems vague, and it does open the door then to have mass arrests in these protests. Then you're brought to jail, denied bail, until your case comes up. Let's not forget that last summer there were some protests in Jacksonville. Dozens of people were arrested. The state attorney ended up dropping charges against just about everybody.
Right.
So, you have a case in where a bunch of people are arrested for mob intimidation, whatever that is, put in jail, and then held without bail. Maybe eventually they get cleared, but they've gone through all that. You know, then it's kind of becomes, well, if I did nothing wrong, but I was arrested, jailed, held without bail, that's going to have a chilling effect on people going out to protest.
We will follow the court challenge to this law. Now, the caller mentioned the most recent caller from Murray Hill said she didn't think it would be a good idea to be putting more people in jail right now because of the pandemic. Federal data out this week shows Florida has more COVID-19 cases tied to newer and more transmissible strains of the virus than any other state. The CDC says Florida racked up more than 3,000 cases of the UK variant, as it's called, or the B117 variant. It's more contagious than the original virus. So case counts, hospitalizations hospitalizations have finally started decreasing a little bit in our area. But deaths overall around the state do keep rising every day as more Floridians are going out and getting vaccinated. 1.3 million Floridians have gotten at least one dose of the vaccine. Charles Griggs, let's turn to you quickly, as you used to work at the Duval County Health Department. Are vaccinations getting done quickly enough in this state to get ahead of the continued rapid transmission of this deadly variant?
Vaccinations are getting done, Melissa, but we do need to see that they get done quicker, because what we're seeing is that, you know, as you mentioned, the cases are rising, and we're getting to a point where we are looking at potential spikes again. The good news is that the hospitalizations are starting to, you know, level off on a downward swing, which means that we hope that means that we won't see the death toll as we've been seeing in the past. But this community, and like across the country, as people focus on vaccinations, they tend to lose sight of the other things that are important to help keep the community safe, which is continuing to wash your hands and social distancing and wearing a mask. And those are the things that are going to get us back to normal. And it's hard to communicate that when we're pushing vaccinations, because vaccinations are, you know, people see that as sort of like a silver bullet. And once they've been fully vaccinated, they feel almost invincible. And that is not the you know, the single way you protect the community. We, you know, have to kind of keep people to continue to take precautions and to look out for their partners and their community, their fellow man as well, and the neighbors.
Thank you for that. And thanks to all four of you, Charles Griggs, Mike Mendenhall, Angela Spears, David Bauerlein. We so appreciate you dropping by and lending your insights to this show. Thanks so much, and have a great weekend.
Have a wonderful weekend, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, everybody. In a moment, Mort Krim joins the show, the famed anchor on his faith, Will Ferrell, and his new book, Anchored. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, the director and co-director of the film Soul, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Film. We talk with Pete Docter and Kemp Powers, who also co-wrote the film. Powers also has an Oscar nomination for his screenplay One Night in Miami, which he adapted from his play of the same name. Join us.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
This is not just for George. This is for everybody around the world.
A landmark moment for justice, or just a moment for justice in America? Plus, the president lays out a new goal to tackle climate change, and the country passes a vaccination milestone. It's all ahead on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Mort Krim calls this area home, but for decades, he covered the news in postings at The Network and as a top anchor in Detroit and Philadelphia. Krim and his colleagues very loosely inspired the Will Ferrell classic Anchorman. But unlike that character, Mort is a serious newsman with some stories to tell, and they're all inside the pages of his new book, Anchored. Mort Krim, a pleasure to talk to you once again. Thanks for being with us.
Always my pleasure, Melissa.
I am excited to talk about your book, Anchored. So what motivated you to write your memoir?
Well, initially, I had friends telling me that once Will Ferrell had identified me as the the impetus behind the spoof Anchorman movies, that I was foolish if I didn't write the story of the real Anchorman.
Right.
Playing off of that publicity. So that was kind of how it started, but it ended up going an entirely different direction. Once I turned the manuscript in to my agent, Susanna Einstein at Einstein Literary in New York, and she called me back and she said, you know, I really like it. It's well written. It's a good story. But she said, you know that I'm Jewish. And I said, yes, I know you're Jewish. She said, well, I never thought I'd be saying this to anybody, but I'm going to say it to you. Your book needs more Jesus.
Really?
And I immediately understood what she was saying. I said, Susanna, I get it. You're saying that more of my spiritual journey and the struggles that I've had with faith over the years needs to come out, because it kept popping up in various places in the book. But her feeling was that it was such a dominant theme in my own life that it needed to be more visible. Mm. So I went back and took another 2 years. I'd already spent 3 years writing it, and I spent another 2 years refashioning the book so that it did touch a lot more on that struggle I've had to answer the big questions, you know, why are we here? What's the universe all about? Is there any meaning to life? And approaching those kinds of cosmic questions gave a different tenor to the book than when it started out to be the life story of the real Anchorman. It is indeed that, but it has this sub-theme.
A sub-theme of faith and how that's changed for you over the years.
And searching and looking for truth.
And so you define truth then, I guess, in a more spiritual way these days than a journalistic way?
Well, I think there's a difference in truth and facts. And, you know, so as journalists, we know, and you know, that you can't always just add up the facts and get truth, because sometimes there are some elements of truth that evade us if we are just totally factual based. And I think particularly when it comes to spiritual life, faith would have no meaning if it were nothing more than just adding up all of the logical points and putting a line under them and totaling it and saying, okay, science will take us so far. But I think there are some truths that are instinctive, that are intuitive, that come to us through the subconscious mind. And I think faith, for me, can't fly in the face of reason. I think, you know, all of my life I've been devoted to reason and facts and to rationality. But there are some truths you can't get to by logic. And the way I illustrate it is my love for my wife and for my children. You could give me 50 logical reasons why I shouldn't love my wife, or 50 logical reasons why I should. It wouldn't matter, because love transcends reason. Now, there might be a case could be made for particularly somebody who's in an abusive relationship or so forth. You could say, okay, it's reasonable for you to leave that relationship. But love itself transcends mere logic. And to me, faith transcends mere logic, but it shouldn't contradict logic. It shouldn't fly in the face of reason. And to me, science and faith are very compatible if you understand the role of each, that they're not competitive. They are two different ways of looking at reality.
Let me, before we let you go, mention to folks that when they come out to your virtual author event on Saturday for the bookmark in Neptune Beach, they will also be not only celebrating your book Anchored, but celebrating Independent Bookstore Day. And I'm sure you'll have a few interesting stories about your career as an anchorman across the country and in broadcasting, both at the network level and in Detroit and Philadelphia.
Yes, it definitely is the story of the real Anchorman. You know, it is a narrative, and it includes many, many stories and subplots of life, which was interesting and exciting and fulfilling as a television and radio newsman, journalist. But I would encourage people to join us for Bookmark's virtual event at 5 o'clock, and they can get information on that by going to a Bookmark on Facebook or visiting the Bookmark website. And we'll be doing who owns the bookstore, will be doing the interview with me, but I believe there will be an opportunity for people to ask questions and to participate. And there will be autographed books available at the store that can be delivered curbside, so people who are concerned about COVID will not have to go in.
Check it out. This Saturday, award-winning journalist and author Mort Krim talking about his new memoir, Anchored, A Journalist's Search for Truth, coming via Crowdcast Saturday afternoon, April 24th at 5 o'clock. Go to bookmarkbeach.com for more, too. Congrats, Mort. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Melissa. Always a pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, Josh Torres, our director, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Make sure to join us today at noon for the Florida Roundup, where we round up the biggest stories across the state. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.